Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of It's Easy Sung, your life lessons on your journey to your purpose. Today, once again, I am pleased and humbled because the guest that we have with us today is someone that I consider to be a pioneer. A pioneer in that if you were to follow his story, he doesn't know that I've been researching his story, but follow his story, you'll see something remarkable with an individual with persistence, passion, and a will and drive that is really interesting. And hopefully in today's discussions, it will come out in our usual way that we get in our conversations with our guests. Ladies and gentlemen, with us today is none other than the managing partner of ICV Partners and chairman of the board of trustees at Morehouse College, Mr. Willie Woods. He's here with us today to share with us and like all our other guests, to inspire us to think a little bit more about what we see in front of us and how we can get beyond it. So, ladies and gentlemen, with no further ado, I welcome to the podcast this week, Mr. Willie Woods. Mr. Woods, good afternoon. How are you?
Daryl, good afternoon. Let me thank you first for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be among the many guests that have been so inspirational that you've had on this podcast. So I humbly thank you for inviting me to participate.
Well, the feeling is mutual, sir, because your story is one that I'm sure our audience will get a lot from. So the ground rules are simple. I don't talk a lot. I'll ask some open-ended questions and just have you share with us your journey all the way from Michigan, Pontiac, Michigan, where you were born and raised, I assume, and all the way through your time through high school and your family, what grounds you in college, obviously Morehouse College, and then what you have done thus far in your professional career, which is outstanding. So with that, let's just get started. If you could just tell us, who is Willie Woods and what grounds Willie Woods and where did Willie Woods start his journey?
So, yeah, Daryl, it's certainly an interesting and unusual story, right? So I, as you had said, was born in Pontiac, Michigan. I have a younger brother and a sister. My mother and grandmother, who's, transitioned, had played a big part in my life. Growing up in Pontiac, Michigan, I basically went to the public school systems and, my mother and father sort of got a divorce when I was in the eighth grade. We were sort of forced to figure out who we wanted to live with. I ultimately chose to initially live with my grandmother because she had been so good to me growing up. My brother, I think, decided to stay with my father. My sister went with my mother. So we were sort of kind of split up. And so I was, in school and a young man in an urban environment, sort of, which is what Pontiac was like, doing all the things that, young men from sort of homes where there were, not two parents and black and African Americans just sort of hanging out in the neighborhood, right? So that's what I did. We hung out on the street corners. We played a lot of basketball at the parks. We didn't always go to classes. We were doing the things that young men who weren't grounded and disciplined and didn't have the right role models were doing. That's how I spent my early years. I ultimately, ended back up with my father in my last 2 years of high school, back with my brother and sort of finished up high school. And that's when it really hit me that I was not focused during all of those years. When I graduated from high school, everybody who was thinking about going to college, was talking about college, and of course, I hadn't thought about college, so now I started thinking about it. I go to the registrar to figure out what my grade point average was, and it was like a 1.9. I mean, it was really bad. right? And it just goes to show you, like, when you don't have any guidance and any role models, and you don't have, you're in a big public high school where, you know, people are just kind of passing you through and nobody's focused and teaching you what you gotta, should be doing, how lost you can get. And that's exactly what happened to me. And so, you know, it was a disappointing end to high school, frankly, right? And, and it's not that I enjoyed high school. I was popular in high school. I was a state, I had made it to the state championship as a wrestler in high school. So I was an athlete. I just wasn't focused on the things that I should have been focused on, which was schoolwork.
Wow. Well, you mentioned your grandmother. You opted to stay with your grandmother because she was that good to you. What did that birth in you, and what was the foundation, or what prompts you to say she's been good to you? And are things that she shared with you still with you today?
Yeah, I mean, my grandmother is like the epitome of somebody who is a hard worker. My grandmother never finished high school, you know, sort of came up from the South, like everybody else who migrated from the South to get a better job opportunities. And my mother was the only child, right? And so me and my brother and my sister were like her only grandkids. And because I was the oldest, I was considered, you know, my brother and sister would still say I was considered the special one. but my grandmother basically cleaned houses. So my grandmother owned a home. And, you know, found a way to buy a home, and she still owns that home to this day. My brother lives in it. And somehow cleaning up people's residential houses, she found a way to pay her bills and have extra money. And so that work ethic of work hard, pay your bills, be responsible is what I learned from her, right? Because it's amazing what she was able to do with so little.
Amen. Amen. So you go through the high school experience. You go to the registrar's office. You get the shock of your life with your GPA. But then you transition to the house, Morehouse College.
Yeah. And so this is an interesting story, Gerald. And so I go through that, right? And now I'm lost as to what to do. And my father, you know, knew somebody at the Urban League who was the director of the Pontiac Area Urban League. And they had, like, some kind of program where you could go work in this camp for a year and also go to college. And being that I didn't want to just be left at home and not doing nothing, you know, I sort of signed up for this Urban League program that I really didn't know much about. And so Gerald, it was on an old army barrack, right? Is where it was. It was outside of Pontiac and Orchard Lake, I believe, or Wall Lake, but some community outside of Pontiac. And we all stayed at the camp. And so first week at the camp, and again, I didn't know much about it. The first day of work was to clean up one of the state parks on a Monday.
Wow.
And I started in the summertime. So hot June weekend where everybody was at the beach. And, you know, my job as part of this work crew was to clean up the park. Every garbage can was filled up to the rim. Mm. And so I spent the day, you know, emptying all of these garbage cans in a truck. You know, because again, the count was you work at these state parks during the day, and those who wanted to go to college sort of did that at night.
Wow.
And so that was day one at the camp, like clean up of camp, empty all of these garbage cans that was filled to the rim. Day two, right, was rake all the seaweed off of the beach, throw it with a pitchfork into a 2-ton truck.
Wow.
And then replant all of the barbecue grills, which you had to dig up, take a sledgehammer, knock the semen off, because most of them were set in concrete, and then replant them back throughout the state park. Now, Gerald, I got to tell you, them first 2 days, I didn't think I was going to make it at the camp, right? And my father said, you will not make it there, because I was complaining about all the work. But somehow my determination kicked in and said, you know what, I'm not going to quit. I don't care how hard this work is. And then I had also registered into a junior college at night. So I was doing the camp and doing this work at these state parks during the daytime, and then going to a junior college at night, taking these classes. Mm. Now, something about me that the director saw something in me, right? The guy that was running the camp. And after a month of doing that work, he invited me and the administrative assistant or administrative person who ran the office. Also, they took a liking to me and they invited me to now come work in the office. So I kind of got out of the field, if you will,
right.
got into the house, uh-huh. right? And now I'm working on accounts receivable and doing these kinds of administrative projects. As you can imagine, you know, the camp and my crew all wondered, what did I do? Now, to give you some context, Gerald, because I didn't know this, the camp was really for people who was either going to jail or in trouble with the criminal justice system. It was sent to this camp as an alternative way to sort of redeem themselves and get better, right?
Wow.
So I was there with some pretty rough people, and I was the youngest person there at like 17 years old.
Wow.
So I was the youngest person there. So I get out of the field, I get in the house, and I got all of my crewmates mad and wondered, how do I get this job? And then 2 months later, I became the crew chief. So I went from working as a member to getting my own crew and having to be in charge of those people in 3 months of being at their camp. And I had made some friends, thank goodness, right? Because, you know, you had to manage these people, and there were a lot of people mad that I skipped through the ranks to get this job, and it appeared that I was getting this sort of special treatment. But at the end of the day, you know, I had some friends who looked out for me. And that's how the camp went. And in the wintertime, and I'll never forget it, in the wintertime, we were working at the park. We were all outside. It gets really cold in Michigan in the wintertime, as you can imagine. And we're all outside trimming trees, shoveling the lake to make an ice rink. And that's when it hit me that I had to get out of Michigan. Right. Mm. My hands were so cold, you know, I could barely, you know, heat them up as we gathered back into the garage to warm ourselves up. And so that's when I started thinking about college. Right. I was like, I got to go to college. Right. There's no question about that. I've learned my mistakes of high school, and this is not the work I want to be doing for the rest of my life. So I have to find a way to get to college. Mm. And there was a counselor at the camp for those who are interested in college that you could talk to. And it's from that guy that I heard about Morehouse and Howard as places for me to consider. You know, I had two cousins who both played basketball in college. One played for the University of New Orleans, and the other one played for Youngstown State. And they both, you know, had sort of worked it out that I could go to college at either one of those two places. And I actually went to visit both of those places. Mm. But at the end of the day, I thought Morehouse was the right place for me. I, Dr. King, the school's reputation, the fact that it was in the South to get me out of this cold weather were all things that I considered. And frankly, I was fortunate enough to get into Morehouse as a transfer student because, I did very well. Yep, I did very well in my junior college classes. And I had a good story to tell as I was thinking about transferring over to Morehouse. And I was fortunate enough to get in, Gerald. That's why, you know, in my mind, I owe such a great debt to Morehouse, right? Because they really took a chance on me. You know, I did not have the kind of SAT score that the typical student now would have, or ACT score for that matter. And I'll never forget when I first got to the college, because I had taken, I think, the ACT and just on a whim, no practice or nothing. And as you can imagine how I did in it, on it. Mm-hmm. And I had all of these. So I get there and they're like, you got to take all of these, you know, prerequisite classes, right? Because you didn't do that great on the ACT. And I'm like, I'll be here forever. It's not going to work. So I go over to my counselor at the time. I'm like, that's not going to work. You just got to put me in these classes and I just got to show you that I'm going to be fine. Right. And they did. Right. So with that's how I got to Morehouse. Right. And it's so funny, right? Because when I got under Morehouse, it's so different from my own kids where, you know, we spent a lot of work and time and coaching them and helping them get into college. I told my parents, I said, oh, by the way, I got into college. They were like, where? I was like, Morehouse College. They were like, where is that? It's in Atlanta, wow. Georgia, right? And y'all are going to have to take me. And of course, my grandmother being who she was like, we got to take this boy to Georgia. So we need to start getting ourselves ready. And her and my mother took me to Morehouse.
Wow.
In August, that hot August day. And I remember, you know, they spent one night and then they dropped me off and I dropped me off in Robert Hall and they were like, good luck.
Good luck. So you made it to the house.
So that's how I got to Morehouse.
That's how you got to. What does the house mean to you? What does Morehouse mean to you? Not only in the role that you currently occupy as the chair of the Board of Trustees, but what happened at Morehouse that reshaped, I guess, or repurposed your drive? Or what did Morehouse mean to you then, and what does Morehouse mean now?
Yeah, I mean, so Gerald, Morehouse was a great place for me, right? Because, you know, I came from a situation where, you know, I wasn't the greatest student. I didn't grow up around a lot of educated role models. I was the first person in my family to go to college. And Morehouse accepted me for who I was, right? They met me where I was and they worked with me. And I can remember as I was, you know, taking, you know, classes, you know, freshman year was a tough year for me, right? Because I was getting adjusted and, you know, learning college and developing study habits. And the teachers and professors were there helping me get there. Students, my brothers at Morehouse, you know, they were there. The brotherhood, the camaraderie that we all had to try to help one another. You know, freshman week where we were there, and the brothers who were the counselors and dorm advisors. You know, we spent a week learning what a Morehouse man was and how a Morehouse man is supposed to act and you know, what's expected of a Morehouse man. And so that week bonding was special. But ultimately it was the investment that the faculty was willing to make in every student to help you get there. The confidence that your fellow classmates had in you and pushed you. You know, people would be correcting my grammar, right? Meaning fellow students, if I said something incorrectly, and they were like, brother, you have Morehouse now, you can't talk like that. You know, I found people willing to help you with classes and so forth. And so it was a place where I felt at home, where I felt people cared about me, and where I thought the out of classroom teaching about, you know, what it is to be a black man in this country and what's expected of you and how great you are. And don't let these people tell you anything different. And you're going to leave Morehouse with a world-class education. There's nothing you're not going to be able to do. You know, the faculty, the freshman seminar and, which was in the chapel, and then regular chapel where they brought speakers in to reinforce that image of what a successful black person looked like. That just transformed me into somebody different, frankly. I grew more confident about myself. I felt comfortable that the the playing field was fair. People extended themselves to me if I wanted some help. And, you know, Gerald, I went from, you know, struggling as a freshman and getting adjusted to having like a straight 4.0 my senior year and graduating with honors and then in the top of the class. And in 4 years.
So you go through the Morehouse experience and you graduate and you're a Morehouse man. Then you went into the workforce, correct? And then I think it was Lehman That's Brothers correct. Or...
No, I actually, it's really, you know, so I was an accounting major. And again, you know, this is the beauty of Morehouse, right? I was an accounting major. First, I was, when I came to Morehouse, I was a computer science major because I was trying to figure out, unlike the kids today and my kids where they go to college to get a great experience, I was going to college to make sure that I had some employment when college was done. So I was trying to figure out what major would assure me that. And I thought computer science, because right in the 80s was when the computers were starting to take off. And so I had gotten to Morehouse and I had taken, you know, a couple of programming classes. And that's when I realized that computer science was not for me. And so, because it didn't naturally click with me how to be a programmer and how to write code and that stuff. Whereas I was taking accounting and that was like automatic to me. It was like I had on glasses. The stuff came natural to me. And I can remember me and my roommate, we'd be arguing about, you know, these accounting adjustments and what's the right way to treat something. And I would be like, you don't see this? And I do. And that's when I realized that business and accounting was made for me. It came to me naturally and easily. And then it was just a matter of figuring out what I wanted to do. And initially, back in those days, Gerald, getting a CPA was a big deal. It was a prestigious thing to do. It was like getting validated, right, if you went and got a CPA. And so initially, that's what I was going to do. I was going to go work for a big public accounting firm. I was going to get my CPA, and I was going to get my career started in business. And somewhere along the road of between junior and senior year and a bunch of interviews with accounting firms, I had decided that accounting was not something I wanted to do. I thought it was too isolated, too boring, you know, too back of the house, if you will. And, you know, I wanted to have interaction with people. And so I switched my career to finance and in banking. Right. And so I had, you know, several job offers as a senior graduating from Morehouse. That was the other thing about Morehouse. Right. It was heavily recruited there. And so there were plenty of job opportunities because people were coming there. And so one of the banks that came to recruit to Morehouse, actually came to recruit at the AU Center. It was National Bank of Detroit. And they were actually looking for MBAs. They were looking for people who were at Clark Atlanta University. And because I'm from Detroit, I saw the bank was coming and I went and talked to the recruiter. And told him, I said, look, I don't have an MBA, but I'd love to talk to you. I'm from Detroit. I'm interested in a banking career. And, you know, wouldn't it be great to come back home? And the guy, you know, Ed Tinsley is his name. I still remember his name. He said, well, you know what, Willie, why don't you come back? And I came back and he decided to bring me back to Detroit for an interview. And I got a job and I had gotten a job from Chase and some others in banking. But I thought it would be great, frankly, for me to go back home and, you know, get engaged and involved in my community, right, where this all started. And so I went back to Detroit and went to work in the credit training program at National Bank of Detroit and ultimately became a commercial lender and responsible for a client base. And I was on, and again, this is the irony, right? You know, I went to the camp that was sponsored by the Urban League. And then when I graduated from Morehouse and went back to Michigan, I was on the board of the Urban League, the Pontiac Urban Area Urban League. And
what goes around comes around.
Yep, I was on the board. And then me and the guy who was the director of the Urban League and some other guys in the neighborhood, we started a youth organization for young men called the Michigan Association for Leadership Development.
Mm-hmm.
And that organization met every Saturday, and we were mentoring in the Pontiac area all the young men who were in middle school and in high school. And all the things I learned at Morehouse about reading the Wall Street Journal and the proper etiquette for how to act on a job interview. And if you're in a dinner, you know, which glass is yours and on which
right.
side of the table and where and all of that great stuff you learn at Morehouse.
Right.
I took all of that and we were teaching these young men. Right. We had Wall Street Journal reading sessions and how to pick stocks in the journal, because this was before the Internet and all of that. And, you know, we had workshops every Saturday for these young men. So I was fully engaged in the Pontiac community, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to go back. And frankly, I was having a very successful banking career. So, you know, it couldn't have been better for me, frankly,
yeah.
after I left the Morehouse.
So you went all the way back to Michigan and then you moved on to the Harvard Business School. So you moved back east again? Is that after several job moves?
Yeah, like all things, right? You have an epiphany, right? And so I was having a great banking career at the National Bank of Detroit and very involved in my community. And there was a great nucleus of Morehouse, Clark, Spelman people in the Detroit area that all had came to work at various banks. So we had a nice community of young Black professionals where we hung out and went to fight parties. And so it was a great experience. You know, I was back home. I tell my sons this, my grandmother, I think I would visit her every single day. If it was for 5 minutes or 30 minutes or an hour, there is not a day I did not go visit her. Because again, when I was at Morehouse, you know, the story I didn't tell you, that is, you know, my freshman year, I had kind of run out of money, right? You being the chief financial officer at Morehouse, you know this story very well, right?
Yes, I do.
I was one of those kids, right, that got in that didn't know how I was going to pay for the next 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got in, got through freshman year, but didn't have any money for a sophomore year and wasn't on any kind of academic scholarship. So I came back sophomore year with no money. And I know you know plenty of people in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
And Wiley Perdue, who's the registrar at the time, I convinced him to let me into the college with $100. I had $200. I told him I only had $100. He said, go pay the $100 and you come up, figure out how to get the rest of the money by October.
Wow.
And I said, great. Where I'm going to stay at. He's like, well, that's your problem. You can't stay on town. I can't. What you mean, let you in college and put you in a dorm, too? Now, luckily for me, one of my best friends who was from Pontiac was also at Morehouse. I came back with him. He had, like, a place to stay. And he worked it out where I could stay with him. The person he was staying with, hey, look, if your friend don't mind, you can stay here with them and I'll cut the rent in half. But it was like $150 and y'all pay me $75 each and let's figure this out. And my friend was like, yeah, of course. And literally, Gerald, like I had called for my other $100.
Mm-hmm.
I had called Delta Airlines. It was $92 to get back to Detroit. And I was on my way to airport to go back home because I didn't have nowhere to stay. And at the last minute, this kind of came through, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is where God steps in, right? If you don't have any religious things about yourself, there are these moments like this where you say to yourself, this is where, you know, God lets you got down right to the last rope, then stepped in
mm-hmm.
and help you cross over. And that's what happened there. Right.
Amen.
Nothing but the Lord blessed me there to and shined a light on those two people that allowed me to stay there. Right. And then I did so well academically. The college found money for me after that. But
wow.
That's another one of those stories around perseverance. Right. Where when it looked dark and looked hopeless, you know, I hung in there and, you know, God found a way to fix it. For me to stay in school. And then obviously I did my part by, you know, doing well in school. the pay it back. So the same kind of epiphany hit me when I was working at NBD, right? I was having a great career. I was reading the Wall Street Journal and hearing about all of these Wall Street tycoons and all of these big deals being done on Wall Street. And I started thinking, gee, maybe I have, you know, maximized my experience here at this bank and I'm ready for another challenge. And so how do I get to Wall Street from Pontiac in Detroit, Michigan? And the only way to get there was to business school, is what I had concluded. And a good business school is what it was going to take. And so I had kind of three business schools in mind, University of Chicago, Stanford, and Harvard. And so I started thinking about business school and had decided, like, despite how great things were going, I was going to apply. And so I went to visit Stanford and Chicago, never went to visit Harvard. And somehow, right, I only had time to complete the Harvard application. So I did, and I got in.
Wow. Oh, God again, huh?
God again.
right down to the wire. So what was the Harvard experience like? Because that launched you, which we'll get to in a minute, but I would assume that Harvard experience launched you into the rather successful career, I would say meteoric rise that you had post-HBS. But tell us a little bit about Harvard and what that, how did that propel you forward to where you are today?
Yeah, I mean, so, Daryl, I mean, I kiss the ground every day, every time I'm on Harvard's campus, right, to thank them for letting me in there, right, because it's a great place. And by the time when I, you know, I get to Harvard, I've now got work experience, I've got more house experience. So I was not threatened or scared or afraid or intimidated at all. I was ready to go when I got there again. I learned my lesson in high school, never again to not put the work in and not do what you're supposed to be doing. And graduating from Morehouse, that only just gave me the confidence that there would be, there's no reason to be fearful. And my work experience was great. So I got there, right? And the Harvard application, which is what I love about it, and I've helped a lot of people, you know, at our firm get into Harvard Business School because, you know, I know the application so well, and I know what they're looking for. It's like 12 questions, right? And those questions are all designed to get the real you, and they want to hear your story, right? And, you know, I told that whole story through those questions about how I got to Morehouse, how well I did at Morehouse, what I did in my community when I left Morehouse, how successful I had been at the bank. And so it was a good story. In a way that when I got to Harvard and my dorm was where the admissions office at, and I walked into the admissions office just to thank them, right? Like, I just want to thank y'all, right? I'm so appreciative of this experience. And they were like, you're Willie? And I'm like, yeah. They were like, oh, yeah, no, we remember your application. It was so inspiring, right? I'm like, you remember my application out of 8,000, 9,000 applications? Like, no, no, we remember the good ones, right? So that was day one. Right.
Yeah,
So quickly we get acclimated to sort of the academic thing. It's a case based method, which is what I liked about Harvard. You know, real life cases. It's not like read books and do practice exams and all of this. It's you have a case and it's a real case and you have to use some tools that you've learned in marketing or accounting or whatever class you're taking. And then you've got to use some business judgment and some experience and develop answers for those cases. So I frankly love that teaching method. I thought it played better for me than being in some classroom and taking exams because it made good use of my experience and my business intuition. And, you know, I enjoy it. Like the way the school is broken down by sort of 90 people per section. You know, I had a great section. Everybody was super friendly. You know, we enjoyed each other. We did things together. As I've told many people, that's where I met Dr. Thomas, President Thomas, I should say. He was our organizational behavior professor in that class. I think he had been at the college for a year or two. So when he walked into the classroom for organizational behavior, there were three black folks in the class out of 90. And we were all, I could see the look on everybody's face like, that's my brother? Where did he find his brother from? Right? Oh, this is going to be great, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it was a great experience on every level. Networking, great people we met. The case method and teachings gave you some great tools for you to be able to take with you when you go into your career. And then obviously the brand and the reputation of the place opened up doors that just would have never been open to me otherwise, right?
Yeah.
And one of the biggest things I did there that sort of cemented my experience and endeared me to a professor there beyond just Dr. Thomas was the work I did with Michael Porter. Michael Porter is like the strategy, a strategy professor at Harvard that's, you know, very well known. He's written a lot of books. A lot of corporate executives had his competition and strategy book on their credenza. I mean, you know, he gets paid $200,000 to speak, so he's very well known. Mm. And he was the competitive strategy professor for my section. Mm. We were lucky to have him. It was the last year he was teaching at the first year level. He teaches now at the executive education level now. And so I got a chance to know him, and I built a relationship with him through that class. And this would have been in 92 when the Rodney King riots happened.
Right.
You remember that whole incident?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I do.
Well, me and a couple of students went to this professor about with a field study idea, right? Because we decided my second year we wanted to take a field study. You have to get a professor to sponsor it. And we got Professor Porter to sponsor this field study on going into the inner city area of L.A. and figuring out what businesses should be rebuilt. And Professor Porter had written a book on competitive advantage of nations that talks about the element of what makes a nation competitive. Like, what is the core industry they have? Like, Japan has electronics. What is the demand of the citizens of that country that drives competitiveness? What's the logistical location? Do they have a port? Are they en route to a major trade route? Like, that could be an advantage. And we read that book in his class, and me and the student who was in my section who went to him with this idea, we thought, well, gee, maybe we can come up with a similar framework for what makes a inner city competitor. And drawing on those dynamics, we could figure out and go down there and work with the Rebuild LA team and the city government around what businesses should be rebuilt after those riots happened or related to Rodney King.
Right.
And he was ecstatic to be involved in that. And off we went and did that work. And it's so funny, right? We all graduated. He gave us the best grade possible because he thought we had did such a good job. We graduated in May, and we didn't turn the final product in until December, right? Mm. So here we were at our job still working on this paper, right? But it allowed me to build a really good relationship with Michael Porter, Professor Porter.
I'll tell you that you are the third HBS grad that I've had on the podcast, and all three of you speak glowingly of the place and what it meant to all of you. And that's a very telling story that you just shared. We have about 20 minutes left, and I would be remiss if I did not ask you. You said something just now. You used two words, business intuition, your business intuition. Now, currently, I consider you one of the stars on Wall Street and African-American and the work that you do and ICV partners and, you know, the growth, I still say meteoric rise of the place. You're you're co-founder of it, I believe. Did Harvard basically put into you this, I want to be who Willie Woods is today, or was that always with Willie Woods?
I think it's a combination of Harvard and Morehouse, right? I think Morehouse gave me the confidence and the ambition that I could do and be anything I wanted. Harvard reaffirmed that and gave me the network and the relationships. And so the way ICV got started, I tell you that Michael Porter story, because the way ICV got started was when we did that work, Michael Porter was so happy with the work that he created a nonprofit called the Initiative for a Competitive Inner City, which I'm to this day on that board. And he fell in love with the inner city and wanting to be helpful. And one of the ways he thought he could be helpful was to raise a fund. And he called me up and asked me, would I help? And I told him, yeah, I certainly would lend my help to it. And it was something really small, like a micro fund, right? Mm-hmm. To do micro lending sort of thing. So it wasn't something for me, right? Because I was, you know, new into my career, and I was at Lehman Brothers, and then I went to Deutsche Bank afterwards. And that's, you know, me, that's where I met Trustee Thaler, by the way, right? I met Trustee Thaler at Lehman Brothers, and then Trustee Thaler went to Deutsche Bank, and then he asked me to join him at Deutsche Bank, where him and I built a really great franchise at Deutsche Bank in investment banking and what was called the Basic Industries Group. So, but the way ICD got started was when I was at Deutsche Bank working with Trustee Thaler, who was my boss at the time.
Really?
Michael Porter. Yeah. He was my boss.
Wow.
Right. And Rich was great. Like, I mean, he treated me like family. And I was in a very unique situation on Wall Street, right? Most African Americans on Wall Street. And at the time, you could count how many it was. It wasn't that many of us in senior positions. And, you know, what we all lacked was mentorship, right? And having a mentor to look out for us. Well, I was fortunate in the sense that I had Trustee Thaler. Rich Thaler was that person for me. He was the group head. He had recruited me to come work in the group. And, you know, he was super supportive of me while I was there at Deutsche Bank. And so during that time, you know, when Michael Porter reached out to me about this fund idea, you know, I didn't think it was the right thing career-wise because it was too small. Yeah. Well, then he went and got a family office partner, family office by the name of American Securities. American Securities was family office for the people who started Sears and Roebuck, Julius Rosenwald. And so then Michael Fish, who was the president of that entity, called me back up and said, Willie, this is going to be much bigger now, and we want you to run it. We want you to build it. We want you to run it. We'll support you. And so they ultimately convinced me to leave Deutsche Bank to start ICV. And so that's, you know, so that's how it got founded that way. And and so that was 21 years ago, Gerald. And here's
21
where
years.
I give it 21 years ago.
Wow.
I give Mr. Thaler, Trustee Thaler, a lot of credit. So when I go to him and tell him I've got this incredible opportunity to, you know, to do something entrepreneurial, right, and leave, you know, a seven-figure salary to go do something as a startup, he was supportive. He said, look, normally I would be trying to talk you out of this, right, because I really need you here. But this may not be a bad thing for you to try. And if it don't work, you know, we would always hire you back. And so he gave me the go-ahead to go give this a try. And even when I announced this, you know, the bank did everything they could to try to keep me at the bank, right? They said, you can work in the private equity group here. And I was like, of course, Mr. Thaler was like, I didn't agree to that. But so with Trustee Thaler's blessing, I left Deutsche Bank and started this new venture with Michael Porter and American Securities that today is ICV. That's, you know, cumulatively raised, you know, $1.4 billion of capital. Latest fund is $585 million. You know, we have 20 employees. We have an office in Atlanta, and we have an office in New York City. And, you know, we manage money on behalf of, you know, large pension funds, New York State teachers, New York, California teachers, Illinois teachers, you know, all of the big municipalities who count on us to deliver, you know, returns for the pensioners.
Right.
But, but yeah, that's 2 decades of doing that work, but it got started from that like work I did with Michael Porter at Harvard Business School. And you know, Michael Porter to this day is an investor in all of our funds.
Wow. Now, I'm going to ask you a question I ask every guest. I think I know the answer based on your story thus far. But when you were coming up, did you see a linear path after you went through the team in going to junior high school at night and that, you know, doing that hard work, and then that epiphany hit you and you ended up at Morehouse? Did you see a linear path to where you are today, or did you have some off-road experiences other than what you've shared here?
Absolutely not. There's no linear path, as you know. The path to success is bumpy and triangulated, right? Uh-huh. It's rigid and jagged, right? And so you get there, right? But you're going to make some turns. You're going to fall off. You're going to have to get yourself back up, right? And every one of those, you know, moments, right? You know, I had to start over, right? I was that moment in high school when I realized that I didn't get what I needed to get done and went to that camp, that was a setback, right? Because everybody else had gone on to college. And there I was at some camp, work camp, right? Doing manual labor with a bunch of criminals, right? When you just put it down that way.
Yeah,
that's a
yeah.
setback.
Right.
So I had to recover from that. Now, I made the best out of it. And I did have that moment, right, where I decided to go to Morehouse. But then when I went to Morehouse, that freshman year was tough, right, because I wasn't used to the rigors of college. Again, I didn't grow up in a family who went to college. So I had to learn that on the job.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. And, you know, and almost, and I didn't have the money for college. So I almost didn't end up finishing college because of financial reasons. And then academically, I had to, you know, I had to strengthen myself. Right. So
mm-hmm.
those were a couple of setbacks almost. Right. Those are scary moments. Right.
Yeah,
you didn't
yeah.
think you were going to get there. And then as I was sitting at the bank, right, thinking about my longer term career, I became more ambitious and was trying to figure out how do I get to the next level of finance, which was an investment banking. Well, to do that, I got to get to Harvard Business School. And so it was great that I went there. But that's 2 years out of your work life, right? That you got to
yeah.
go to college and think about what you want to do, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And it all worked out because I got into investment banking like I wanted to. And so all the things I wanted to do, I got done. When I was in investment banking, that's when I learned about private equity. And so I had a lot of private equity clients. I was thinking about private equity. I was thinking about how to be an entrepreneur. And even though I was having this successful career in investment banking, the back of my mind, I was trying to figure out, did I want to do that long term? And the answer was no, I didn't. And I was determined to find a way to figure out how to be an entrepreneur. And private equity was that perfect blend of being an entrepreneur, but being a finance person, right?
Mm-hmm,
because, you know, we buy the company. And we help the companies, but we don't run the companies. That's a whole management team that does that work.
Right.
But we do provide the financing and we provide the consulting and the help. So it was a good balance, you know, of the skills I had. And so I had decided in banking that I wanted to get into private equity and that would be a better entrepreneurial experience in banking. And I was able to make that happen. But think about it, right? You leave a seven-figure salary job where your boss loves you and you're well-positioned to be successful to a startup,
right?
Right? That you don't even know if you're going to raise the money.
Right.
Now, you with some good people, so it ain't completely like you're alone, but it was very risky. And it was some days where I had wondered if I had made a mistake.
Wow.
By leaving my banking job and starting this firm, right? There were some days where I wondered if we were going to get that done.
Wow. And look where you are today. You are a unique,
right.
You are a unique guest in that you are the chair of the Board of Trustees at Morehouse College. And we have about 10 minutes left, and I have two questions that I'd like you to share your thoughts on. For you as the chair of the Board of Trustees at Morehouse, how do you see Morehouse today, given all that you are seeing happening with race relations, and it looks like some folks want to turn the clock back a question I asked Dr. Thomas, is, I think I asked Dr. Thomas as well, is Morehouse today just as needed as it was when we were earlier years, when things, quote unquote, were a little bit tighter? But given what you're seeing happening today and Morehouse and that Morehouse ethos, how do you see that interplay today? Is it needed today now more than ever, or is there something else?
Yeah, I mean, Gerald, I mean, you, before I even answer that, I do want to highlight, you are absolutely right. I mean, being the chair of Morehouse's board is like unimaginable to me, right? When I was a freshman in 1981, sitting in King Chapel, as Dean Carter got us all organized and silenced us so we could get ready, I could have never imagined me being the chairman of the Morehouse Trustee Board. And I can remember the first graduation, right, that I had to officiate as the chairman. That feeling I got when I looked out in the crowd and saw all of those kids and looked in that area where I was sitting all those years ago and thought about how proud my grandmother would have been, because she could have never imagined this neither. Right, that I'm actually the chairman of the board of Morehouse, the school that I struggled financially to stay in, right? And the school that she had to pay, you know, my rental payments for the last 2 years. Again, a woman who worked for cleaning people's houses somehow found a way to help me pay my rent, my $75 every month. But back to your question, there is no question, right, that what Morehouse does, and for young Black men in this country and the leaders that it produces and the light that it provides, is needed more than ever in these dark times. We need to double down on our Morehouse effort. We need to get more Morehouse men out there leading, being the shiny examples, doing away with these, you know, unconscious biases and stereotypes that exist on Black men. As you know, Black men has it very tough, right? We are over-indexed, bad for everything. Murder rates, poor graduation rates, criminal justice or an incarceration rates, and everything bad that people think about, the image of a young Black man comes to mind, unfortunately, right? And it's gotten worse today, as you can see it playing out with all of these social injustices and police brutalities and stereotypical things that's happening to young Black men and women too, for that matter, right? And so we need a school in this country that's going to attack that problem, that's going to provide examples of people and leaders to sort of shatter those stereotypes, right? Mm-hmm. We need Morehouse College more than ever today than we've needed it any time before, in my opinion.
Amen. Amen. All of our HBCUs, but this Morehouse is something special. Having been at the college now for a year and some months, COVID has impacted us this year. But to walk up Brown Street and see, you know, the young brothers just talking, it's something to behold. Well, I have to ask you this last, it's not a question, but it's really just asking you words of inspiration that you would want to leave with the audience. As I share with my guests, a number of the audience, that's makeup of the audience, it's young people and their parents, and believe it or not, young professionals. Given all that you've shared today and you reflect upon your story and where you started and where you are today, what words of inspiration or encouragement could you leave with us after spending almost this hour with us sharing and reminiscing and actually encouraging us just through your story? But what words of inspiration and wisdom, I should say, you could leave with us as we come to a close?
Yeah, my words of wisdom, and, you know, I heard, you know, Dean Carter's podcast, which, you know, wisdom, he said, comes from pain, right, and learnings, right?
That's right.
And so I've got a lot of that, right? It's not been an easy road. And the words of wisdom I have for, you know, everybody, and particularly young black men and young black women too, is that don't give up no matter what happens. You can do this. You can achieve the things you want to achieve as long as you are willing to do the work and put the time in, right? If you do that and believe in yourself, good things will happen, right? Things that you never expected will fall out of the sky for you, right? Because of your work ethic, your perseverance, your heart, right? You got to be a good person too. You can't walk all over people. So you got to do it in the spirit of being a good person. So if you do those things, put the work in, show the effort, have a good heart, have a real goals that are realistic and are marching to get that done, do not be dissuaded by the barriers that get in your way, because there will be some things that will get in your way. You just got to be willing to, you know, fight it out, be willing to take whatever steps backwards to move forward, and blessings will fall out of the sky for you. And so don't give up under no circumstance.
Amen. Amen. Well, Chairman Woods, I really do appreciate you spending this almost an hour with me, little old me, as I try to inspire and help young people to realize that their station in life, whatever it may be, if they have the grit and they have the determination and the focus, they can indeed be successful, whatever they deem to be successful. Sir, it has been a pleasure and an honor for you spending this time with us and sharing your story. And this is now my 17th episode, and I can always tell which ones are going to get the requests for the recording as quickly as possible. And Harvey Gantt and Dean Carter, Dr. Thomas, and Oliver McIntosh, another HBS grad, the stories and your authenticity around sharing really connects with folks. And listening to your story, sir, is one of those that is truly going to inspire some of our listeners and our viewers. And I thank you immensely for joining us today.
Thank you, Gerald, for having me. Hopefully I said something that was inspirational.
Oh, absolutely. You did. Thank you so much, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, you've just listened to the words of wisdom from Mr. Willie Woods, another stellar Morehouse grad and a gentleman that is in the business of shaping lives. This is It's Easy, Son. And until next week, take care, and you have a great week. Take care. Bye-bye.